There's something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I've got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome home to Passionate Justice 74. Thank you all for your continuing growing support. I'm so pleased more and more of you are following the show on Twitter. For all Passionate Justice news, releases, podcasts, I ask all of you, follow the show at jwolf41387 at jwolf41387 on Twitter. And now, a new hour, personal notes, super guest writers, spurring you on every week, every day, a new challenge to create just a little more justice in our world. And yes, join. I'm asking you to join Our Salon, the very best readers and writers site on the internet, growing, and it's hosted by Lori Wright, and it's free. Join now at www.oursalon.ning.com. oursalon.ning.com. Join Our Salon. I am author, activist Jonathan Wolfman, the spark for these stories. Passionate Justice, a progressive memoir in essays, is available at Amazon, and I'm proud to say, so very proud, that underwriting for Passionate Justice in 2015 comes from Bud Clayman and OC87 Productions, producers of OC87, RecoveryDiaries.com, and the feature-length film OC87, The Obsessive-Compulsive Major Depression Bipolar Asperger's Movie. I want you to check out OC87, RecoveryDiaries.com. Straight away, I want to remind you, yes, again, our very important program note and a request that could put you on the radio. That's right, you. We're in the run-up to the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, and if you're honest, you'll agree that Viet War vets, man, they've been treated shabbily. But on April 30, our morning show, Upfront and Outspoken with Bob Williams, will honor our men and women who served in Southeast Asia, and you can be a part. If you have a personal experience you wish to share for this tribute, please, now, email Bob Williams at kkrp1610@yahoo.com. And in the subject line, all you got to do is write VET, V-E-T. Again, that's kkrp1610@yahoo.com. Be part of an amazing tribute. Thank you so much. So straight away, let's hop that Jefferson airplane. Be a volunteer of America. You and me, volunteers of America. We're going to jump right back on into Marietta, Georgia, because we must report terrific news from our friends in Georgia, Angela Williams and the group Voice Today, who worked so hard, as we told you a few weeks back, to get their legislature, Georgia's legislature, to stiffen the child sexual predator laws. The bill that just passed gives victims more time to bring legal action, and it opens court files for their inspection. The House bill passed by a solid margin, and get this, now the Georgia State Senate bill, it passed with no opposition. None. Passionate Justice and Starcom congratulate all the volunteers of America, such as Ms. Williams and Marietta George's Voice Today, for knowing that hard work can enhance justice. And we congratulate you for staying the course. Voice Today, Marietta, Georgia, our hats off to you and your director, Angela Williams. Now, think for a moment. Do you fidget? Do you yawn? Do you sometimes clear your throat in ways that some people might consider conspicuous? Do you whistle? Do you sweat? Do you stare? Do you look at the floor? Do you sit up straight? Do you appear to have recently shaved your beard? Do you at times appear, arrogant? Well, if so, you may wish to take your next trip by car, train, or Disney cruise, as the TSA, Transportation Security Administration, may well snatch you up, pat you down, interrogate your ass, if not your soul, if you display these and or other characteristics its agents now use to nab airport undesirables. The Intercept got a hold of TSA document, its profiling checklist aimed at identifying terrorists in, near, on, thinking of, dreaming of, planes. Its programs called SPOT, S-P-O-T, Screening of Passengers by Observation Techniques. And I quickly wonder, SPOT, SPOT, if Dick and Jane run it, because I wonder, too, if the folks behind SPOT and the list really do appreciate, even if silently, its absurdity, or if it's a wordy, seriously considered cover for racial, ethnic, religious, The Intercept tells us that the checklist ranges from the mind-numbingly obvious, like, appears to be in disguise, which is worth 3 points, to the downright dubious, like a bobbing Adam's apple. I'm not kidding. Many indicators, like trembling and arriving late for flight, appear to confirm allegations that the program picks out signs and emotions that are common to many people who fly. TSA is fast to say that the program's more layered than it may at first appear. Since its introduction in 07, the SPOT program has attracted controversy for the lack of what? Well, for the lack of any kind of science supporting it. Science? Reliability? Oh, who the hell cares? In 2013, the nonpartisan, and it really is nonpartisan, Government Accountability Office found that there was no evidence to support the idea that behavioral indicators can be used to identify those who may pose an added risk to aviation security. After analyzing hundreds of actually scientific studies, ones that were actually scientific, the GAO concluded that the human ability to accurately identify deceptive behavior based on behavioral indicators is how good? How good? Well, it's the same as or slightly better than chance. That's right. It's random. Well, Dick, Jane, and Spot have spent just under how much of your bucks? On this idiocy since 2007, 1 billion of your bucks. Oh, good dog, Spot. Yeah, comforting, particularly for travelers such as my son. 25, 6 foot, 220, and black. The 92-point checklist listed in the SPOT referral report is divided into various categories with a point score for each. The categories include a preliminary observation and behavioral analysis, and then those passengers pulled over for additional inspection are scored based on two more categories: whether they have unusual items like almanacs and numerous prepaid calling cards or cell phones, and a final category for signs of deception, which include covers mouth with hand when speaking and fast eye blink rate. And camo? Camo? Last time my son flew from Dulles, right outside D.C. here, in Virginia, he and four Marines and a Coast Guard man were pulled from line. Their shared characteristics, aside from gender and race, was that they carried themselves with self-assurance and they wore, camo. One of my son's motorcycle jackets has a camo design. Oh dear. Passengers are scored. Points can be deducted from someone's score based on observations that make him or her less likely in the TSA's eyes to be a terrorist. For example, apparent married couples, if both people are over 55, have 2 points deducted off their score. Women over the age of 55 have 1 deducted. For men, the point deduction doesn't come until they reach 65. Oh dear, I've got one more year. The TSA has insisted, you see, that keeping documents about SPOT, they insist on keeping them secret, but the agency can't hide the fact that there's no evidence that the program works. And that was said by Hugh Handyside, staff attorney with the ACLU National Security Project. Their report concludes, largely on the strength of the fact that there's virtually no evidence that the programs tended toward our increased safety, the ACLU says that the SPOT sheet was designed in such a way that virtually every passenger is going to exhibit multiple behaviors that can be assigned a SPOT sheet value. A former TSA manager says it's nothing more than a license to harass. Another former Behavior Detection Administration says the program suffers from lack of science and simple inconsistency with, get this people, get this, every airport training trains its officers differently. Oh, good. And my son, who worked for Delta in a technical capacity, confirms this. The SPOT program is just bullshit, the manager said, and my son just smiles and nods. My son, as most do, acknowledges calmly that he does live in a world rife with bullshit. He has keen senses of irony and self-preservation. Yeah, my son does have a keen sense of irony and self-preservation, but he asks, need we pay this much for it in loss of money, time, and good sense? See, people, look, here's a bottom line. Bullshit. Bullshit, particularly institutional bullshit, has a purpose, even if it's only to convince reasonably trainable functionaries and administrators, agency directors, and politicians that they're useful. And if it's layered and costly enough bullshit, it can cover motives more toxic than that. Now, a few weeks back, I told you that Starcom's home, Oklahoma, has passed California as our state with the most earthquakes. Well, true, the earthquakes Oklahoma gets are not 7, 8, and 9 pointers, but as to sheer number, Oklahoma's winning now. And we've told you there's reason, damn good reason, to believe that fracking is at the root of this dubious Okie honor. Remember, too, that over a year back, we brought you the story of young Mariah Stevenson. Do you remember that? She was the University of Oklahoma grad student with the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance. And I gotta say, boy, is that a wonderful group of activists. Well, she was arrested and threatened with 10 years in prison for demonstrating on the sidewalk in front of Devon Energy, one of the Oklahoma City energy companies most responsible for turning her state into a gaseous, unstable hell. Now, I want to share with you again her January 2014 statement. I think we have a lot of new listeners now right here at Passionate Justice who did not hear Mariah Stevenson's statement, not originally, and it's important, and I want to share this with you again. Here's Mariah Stevenson of the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance. She says this: I grew up in Oklahoma, chasing thunderstorms and running barefoot in pastures. I know the smell of a tornado. I know Oklahoma's streams and smiles and sunset, open spaces. I also know Oklahoma heartache. I know what fracking flaring looks like when the excess natural gas is burned off into the air, sometimes for weeks, months, years on end. I know what the water looks like after a frack site has wreaked its havoc. And I know what cancer looks like after the water has gone bad and the flares stop burning. I'm saddened by the natural gas and oil industry's greed and disregard for life, and I think it's important to draw attention to Devon's involvement in fracking and tar sands mining through nonviolent, peaceful acts of civil disobedience, My name is Mariah Stevenson, and on December 13, 2013, I attended a nonviolent, peaceful protest at the Devon Energy building that was intended to draw attention to Devon's involvement in hydraulic fracking and tar sands mining. My intention was to hang a glittery banner that was dramatic, pretty, and would highlight the similarities between Devon's disregard for life and the Capitol's disregard for life as portrayed through the fictional story told in The Hunger Games. I'm a waitress and I'm a student at the University of Oklahoma. I had two papers due the weekend of the 13th. After the protest, my intention was to go home and work on the papers. I'd no intention of going to jail or scaring anyone. When we unfurled the banner, you see, and saw the glitter fall to the ground, we immediately felt guilty because we knew the janitor would have to clean it up, but there was no panic, and almost immediately Devon employees began touching the banner and taking it down. Our hope was for the banner to stay up as long as possible, not to create any kind of scare. As we exited the building, a janitor began cleaning up the glitter with a broom. No hazmat, no FBI. Again, there were no hazardous materials involved, unlike in fracking. We apologized for the mess. We exited the building and rallied on a public sidewalk with other protesters. The police arrived and began looking for some way to book us all into jail. The police arrested two of us and booked us into jail under the charge of terrorism hoax. Terrorism hoax. But I know the sound of real terrorism. I felt the Murrah building bombing shake my body. I'll never forget. My grandfather, a doctor, provided free medical care for those wounded. I was chosen to paint a tile for the memorial. Calling nonviolent, peaceful protesting terrorism is an insult to all those who suffered due to the indiscriminate violence that ensued on April 19, 1995. Activism that is attempting to protect land and lives in Oklahoma, that is not terrorism. Charging us with terrorism hoax for hanging up a glittery banner is insulting to all those who have experienced real terrorism. TransCanada Corporation has been encouraging the police to charge environmental activists with varying charges that contain the word terrorism in order to scare us and silence our dissent. You know, my hometown is older than Oklahoma statehood and is now being destroyed by the oil and gas industry. In rural Oklahoma, where people go to see the stars at night, I've seen the brightness of fracking flares dim out the stars. It's heartbreaking to think that we've reached a point in which I could face 10 years in prison for peacefully hanging up a banner. Ultimately, this is an issue of free speech. A corporation is using scare tactics to try to silence my story and my voice. If nothing else, it's unfair for TransCanada and Devon to engage the government in silencing free speech through the threat of terrorism charges. Now, that was Mariah Stevenson in December 2013. Now, people, understand this. Devon Energy and TransCanada, these are the predators trying to frack up and keystone pipeline the entire plains from the Canadian line north into Alberta, Canada, south to the Gulf of Mexico. You should support the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance. Find out at their Facebook page more about Mariah Stevenson and her case. The Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance. Find out more about it. Now, we know that activists such as Ms. Stevenson are not terrorists, and yet we also know that there are terrorists in our world. There are. That's just a fact. Our friend, Irish writer in Sri Lanka, Padraig Colman, and we've heard numbers of pieces from him. You may recall his piece, Anosmia, about his father's condition of not being able to smell anything after he was assigned in the British Army to bury the dead at the invasion beaches in Normandy. Well, our friend Padraig Colman now shares a new related piece related to terrorism, from which I excerpt this. He calls his piece Freedom Fighters, Terrorists, and Ordinary Decent Criminals. The article appeared originally in the publication Ceylon Today on the 31st of last month, March 31st, 2015. Padraig says, "The world was horrified recently at the news that co-pilot Andreas Lubitz had deliberately flown his plane into the Alps, killing 150. Many commented this was the ultimate expression of modern narcissism, a trend for suicidal people to want to take others with them without their consent. I wrote just last week about how Irishman Kieran Conway, in a book in which he calls himself a freedom fighter, admitted responsibility for killing 21 innocent young people in the cause of a united Ireland. No one asked those dead children what they thought about it. Terrorism is a kind of narcissism. Terrorism is a kind of narcissism. There are fuzzy boundaries, of course, between war, terrorism, crime, politics, and business. Politicians use terms like war on terrorism, war on crime, war on drugs. Some might believe this is part of a plan to militarize civil society. Freedom fighters easily morph into criminals as they resort to bank robberies, drug dealing to raise funds for the cause. Many once considered terrorists later on. Some later on take spots in government. In Ireland, there was Eamon de Valera, and more recently, Martin McGuinness. In Kenya, there was Jomo Kenyatta. Today, his son is president and has had his terror case dropped by the International Criminal Court. MIA made it into the news again the other day. It was not for any recent achievement, but merely about a gripe that she regurgitated concerning the way Oprah Winfrey had treated her some time ago. Suggestions that the celeb MIA was a terrorist sympathizer led to some people dragging out that old chestnut. One man's terrorist's another man's freedom fighter. Whenever this is said, no potential understanding of freedom fighter is offered. No examples of bona fide freedom fighters are presented, aside from Nelson Mandela. He's the only one they ever mention. Ronald Reagan called the Nicaraguan Contra rebels freedom fighters. Reagan also frequently called the Afghan Mujahideen freedom fighters during their war against the Soviet Union. Yet, 20 years later, when a new generation of Afghan men fought against what they perceived to be a regime installed by foreign powers, George W. Bush labeled their attacks terrorism. Professor Martin Rudner, director of the Canadian Center of Intelligence and Security Studies at Canada's Carleton University, says the phrase, one man's terrorists, another man's freedom fighter, is grossly misleading. The problems that the phrase assesses the validity of the cause when it should be addressing terrorism as an act. I'm going to say that one again. The problem with saying one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, why is it misleading? Because it assesses, that phrase assesses the validity of the cause when it should be addressing terrorism as an act. See, one can have a perfectly beautiful cause, and yet if one commits terrorist acts, it's terrorism nonetheless. Distinguished scholars have devoted their lives to defining terrorism and have admitted failure. In the first edition of Political Terrorism, a research guide, Alex Schmidt spent 100 pages examining more than 100 different definitions of terrorism. And 4 years later, in that second edition, he admitted that in the first sentence of his book, that he can't find an adequate definition. Professor Walter Lacour despaired of defining terrorism in both editions of his work on the subject, and he maintained that it's neither possible to do so nor worthwhile to try to do it. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter seems to mean that the state authorities sometimes delegitimize opponents and legitimize the state's own use of armed force. Critics call this state terrorism. Everyone agrees that terrorism is a pejorative term with intrinsically negative connotations. Use of the term implies a moral judgment. Just the use of the term implies a moral judgment. According to David Roden, utilitarian philosophers can, in theory, conceive of cases in which the evil of terrorism is outweighed by the good that could not be achieved in a less morally costly way. Writer Michael Walzer argued that terrorism can be morally justified in only one specific case, when a nation or community faces the extreme threat of complete destruction, and the only way it can preserve itself is by intentionally targeting non-combatants, then it is morally entitled to do so. Those who carried out the Irish Easter Rising in 1916 are seen in a romantic light compared to the bombers of today. Yet, like the bombers of today, they believed in 1916 that they were entitled, although they were but a small, unelected group of conspirators in a democratic country, to stage a revolution in which many innocent people were killed. The whole point of terrorism is to induce fear among non-combatants. It's a bit laughable for those committing these acts of terror against civilians to call themselves freedom fighters, and yet I must confirm, criminal acts intended or calculated to provoke a state of terror in the general public for political purposes are abhorrent, whatever political or philosophical justifications are presented. So I ask you, as we thank Padraic Colman, is there any act that you would call terrorism that you could ever justify? Okay, perhaps. Tell us in what circumstance you would justify it. And we will be right back. Welcome back. It's the second half of Passionate Justice 74, and I remind you, follow the show, follow this program on Twitter at jwolf41387, at jwolf41387 on Twitter. Follow us. And I remind you to send your Vietnam War memories to KKRP 1610 at yahoo.com for our special tribute to these veterans on April 30, the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. Send your Vietnam memories to KKRP 1610 at yahoo.com. And yes, yes, join the very best readers and writers site on the net, www.ursalon.ning.com. Our Salon, the finest readers and writers site you're ever gonna see. Now, we've heard a great deal about the attempts in various states, Indiana, Arkansas, for example, to legalize discrimination against LGBT citizens, to the point where those taking comfort and joy from these efforts, some restaurateurs, for example, have gotten their 15 seconds of infamy on local media, and delighted they may get the state's backing if they decide not to deliver the breakfast special to Table 5, if some people at Table 5 seem to the restaurant owner to be gays or lesbians, but then, of course, the laws changed a little bit there because of the very good corporate and individual pushback, and then they said, well, we'll serve them in the restaurant, we just won't cater their weddings, that is, gay people. Have you ever heard of gay people being so inelegant that they would want pizza for their weddings? Oh, but you see, they meant their Super Bowl parties, too. Seems their religion tells them, Jesus must have said somewhere that nobody can find, that Super Bowl parties cannot be catered if anybody there is gay. Well, aside from the fact that this just is not what a mature country should want law to do, those on the increasingly losing end of the equality debate are going much further than this, and it goes underreported. Take Tennessee. No, you take Tennessee. Wait. What if you've heard about this? Now, I know that you've been told about Indiana and Arkansas, but they are nothing compared to this. Writer Carrie Ann in Addicting Informations tells us that a new law brings real theocracy to Tennessee, and she warns that the Christian right is coming for your state. Tennessee Republicans have introduced legislation that would establish the authority of God in the Tennessee Constitution. You think I'm kidding? These words would be added to Article 1 of the Constitution of the State of Tennessee. Quote, we recognize that our liberties do not come from government, but from Almighty God, our Creator and Savior. Unquote. Now, see, it's the Savior part that establishes Tennessee as a formally Christian state because, of course, non-Christians do not speak of a Savior. It's perfectly all right with me, you see, if Christians speak of a Savior, but given the fact that they do and want that word in the constitution of a civil state, well, bloody forget it. You see, it is the Savior part that establishes Tennessee as a formally Christian state. Non-Christians don't use that word. See, what this would do, it would establish the Christian church within the legal systems of the state, rendering it a theocracy rather than a democracy. I don't think that's an overstatement. A parallel move, get this, a parallel move would designate the Holy Bible, one version of the Holy Bible, by the way, as the official state book of Tennessee. Sounds rather involuntary to me for a place calling itself with pride the Volunteer State And by the way, a prize to the first person to write me at jwolf41387@aol.com with the reason Tennessee calls itself the Volunteer State. But Tennessee, you see, isn't alone. Religious tyranny has already arrived in Michigan with House Bill 5958, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The bill legalizes a Christian extremist's religious freedom to discriminate and commit other breaches in law. That's right, breaches in law and social mores. How do I know this? Because the bill in Michigan makes it legal to refuse service, deny employment, deny housing, and violate other citizens' rights, any rights, if a person claims it violates the religious freedom and objects on religious grounds. As if this were not rotten enough, our deepest concerns, I think, should be reserved for the Orwellian-titled Conscience Clause of this bill. Listen carefully. Listen very carefully. The clause allows any Christian fundamentalist working in the healthcare industry to cease, yes, to stop a patient's medical care if they claim their objection is founded on religious beliefs, and the healthcare provider would be obliged to send a patient away. Huh? What would it allow? It would give legal cover to religious pharmacists to refuse to fill prescriptions if they think a customer is gay, a woman is a single mother, or the patient is of the wrong religion. It'd also mean a first responder or law enforcement or fire protection officer or ambulance personnel can use religious objections to refuse to provide service to a person or group they feel violates their religious beliefs. In fact, the Christian right have been attempting to break the constitutional separation of church and state at least since the latter half of the 20th century. This vicious idiocy doesn't occur overnight, people. It creeps up. The Pledge of Allegiance, and I have brought this up to you before on Passionate Justice. You know who wrote the Pledge of Allegiance and when? It was written in 1892 by the openly socialist minister Francis Bellamy. The original Pledge of Allegiance read, quote, "I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all." This was all changed by President Eisenhower in 1954 when he convinced Congress to insert God into the pledge. Ike claimed, you see, that this would mark out the U.S. as a Christian nation in contrast to Cold War Russia, as a communist nation, as if the two were mutually exclusive and morally opposed. But they didn't stop with the pledge. The Christian right has inserted itself into the democratic institutions and processes of the state with terrifying speed and with extraordinary success. Since the 80s, groups like the Moral Majority, the Christian Coalition, Focus on the Family, Family Research Council, have sought to turn their religious ideologies into civil law. Into civil law. The White House of born-again Christian George W. Bush put America behind the rest of the scientific world community by preventing Congress to work on stem cell research. The Republican war against women is all about the Christian right of the party enshrining their version of the faith in law. As a result, we see legislation limiting access to abortion and birth control and lobbying against legislation to outlaw spousal rape. They want to stop legislation outlawing the rape of your wife. What does it mean precisely? What does it mean? It means these people want the law. These people want the law to insist that once a woman marries, she relinquishes control over when she has sex. Period. That's what it means. The Christian right is trying to turn us into a theocracy. one law, one state at a time. It's on all of us, all Americans who respect secular democracy and the separation of church and state envisioned by our founders. We got to head them off at the pass. And I would add this. I would add this. And think about this very strongly. If you really would feel more comfy, if you really would feel more comfy living in a theocracy, living under religious law, I want you to consider emigration to Saudi, to Iran, or maybe you just want to be a volunteer for ISIS. Now, I've been telling you about Starcom's plan to air Vietnam War-related pieces at the end of April on the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. And I think it's very important, regardless of back then, what you thought of the war, what you think of it now. It's an important part of our history, and the people who served and lived, served and died, we need not brush them away. But I want you to take a listen to this piece from our Ohio friend who we've had on numbers of times before. She calls herself Songbird. She's a poet. Listen to her poetic essay, Letters, Sisters, Friends, Lovers, and Others. Songbird tells us, of note at times in my life is the way the military interrupts our lives, not in the same way as the generation above us, with World War II ringing in the patriotism of downing the genocide of the monster. That was to be had at any and all cost and came at that very great price. Those of us who grew up with that pride, that seen honor, and the grace of our fathers were imbued with that spirit, but it was another time and another war when our time came. And behind the scenes, just as our mothers had been, we were girls who were anchors, buoys, linchpins, and connects to home's reality for our own generation's boys who went off to an elsewhere that was not even known at onset. We kept losing them. History told us the toll. We wrote letters, lots of them. I myself wrote so many letters that I don't even remember all to whom. My brothers, of course, who both chose to be sailors so as not to be a first defense line's fire, infantry at their numbers call, but to some of their pals as well, liked enough to be entrusted to converse with their sister, fellas I knew from high school classes, many of them neighbors, a few that had asked me out. But all of us, fresh changed from the days of just walking home from school together, shucking and teasing, branching off at varied intersections as our homes neared. I remember the month that we lost three of us. I remember the month we lost three of us in one rapid-fire swoop, the disbelief and wonder giving way to what the heck was going on. We'd lived within blocks, had been playmates, didn't take much notice of what compass points we'd come to the hilltop from. We just knew where we'd landed, our varied cityscapes of childhood, hopscotch, jump rope, hide and seek, spin the bottle, given way to Stand By Me, exploring both farm fields for treehouse building and railroad tracks for frog gigging and strange wildflowers to be picked, and the onset of big grocery stores. And it was in these letters that the exactness of that new mundane got transferred from girl to boy, and in innocence and hope we kept charge of them. To us, some of the adventure of it came. Where are you now? The exotic names of places so different from the same olds of the familiar neighborhood we knew, updates of anything of an equal excitement. Wow, Mr. Dyer bought an Avanti. Were silly things, but now that it's all past and so maltreated, there are those of us who feel really dear about buoying those who did survive, made their own place, and create more families like the very ones we embraced. It was another rite of passage that doesn't get much notice. None is needed nor wanted, but it's just one of those lonely things you come to know of yourself, the generation you're in and own, and how you treat it. Even unknowingly, we all create the we's that we are by little intricacies. The men who became the strangers in the strange lands by their soldierings are indeed held dear, defended, loved, empowered by us girls and women, who are, after all, the very thing fought for, with much love in remembrance of my brothers. So let's give thanks for writers such as Ohio's Songbird. Now a real treat for you. In October 2013, a wonderful writer, Amy Abbott of rural Indiana, a long-standing writing colleague of mine and I, organized a dinner here at my place outside Washington, D.C. during National Book Week. About 15 writers from all over, a number who you know through Passionate Justice, Leslie Bishop, A.J. Calhoun, for example. They all flew, drove, trained in, and we had a wonderful evening. And now I get to share with you a piece from author Amy Abbott, whose column, The Raven Lunatic, ran in newspapers for 6 years. She's currently featured on Senior Wire News Service, and Amy now has an author's page on Amazon. All three of her books are there. All are available in trade paperback or on Kindle. This is one of Amy's favorite pieces, The Past is Prologue. Year-end is often a time of reflection, a time to regroup and make new plans. I rarely make resolutions for the future. I'm more inclined to study the past. A reader recently asked me why I write so much about the past. It's a fair question. I've been interested in history in the micro and macro sense since I was a child. My maternal grandmother tracked genealogy on both sides and bequeathed my family documents and photographs. Each is a treasure, a puzzle piece in the family story of immigrants who came to a new country. On my mother's side, the journey started in England and Germany and ended in northeastern Indiana. My parents took my brother and me to historic sites when we were children. How better to understand the impact of the Civil War than to stand in the cemetery where Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address? My family story is no better, worse than thousands of immigrant families who came to Indiana. Knowing our past teaches us, you see, about ourselves and our world. Knowing the challenges from both sides of my family and how they overcame them is a great object lesson for today. My mother's ancestors came to Indiana from the United Kingdom via Pennsylvania behind a team of yoked oxen. When we drive out east to visit our son, I wonder how difficult it was for them to cross the Appalachians. The mountainous areas of West Virginia don't threaten two individuals in a small SUV. Imagine going over rough terrain in a wagon pulled by a team of oxen. Perhaps my ancestors felt they had no other choice than to push on. Perhaps what was gained in Indiana was greater than what was lost in Europe. Their ultimate resolve makes me think I can accomplish anything. The National Archives in Washington has What's Past is Prologue engraved on the base of a statue in front. From Shakespeare's The Tempest, the full quote is, "And by that destiny to perform an act, whereof what's past is prologue, what to come in yours and my discharge." Shakespeare's Antonio was referring to a murder. In the centuries since, The play was written. The quote has come to mean history can teach us what's ahead. None of us can know what the future holds. I'm not sure I would want to know, given a magic crystal ball. However, we can perhaps find a clue in our past and learn meaningful stories along the way. Oh, is that good writing? Thank you, Amy McVeigh Abbott. Her site is www.amyabbottwrites, AmyabbottWrites.com, and I want you to get her wonderful books. I've read them. They're marvelous. The Luxury of Daydreams, A Piece of Her Mind, and most recently, A Piece of Her Heart. They're poignant, and many of the pieces are just hilarious. Amy Abbott, read her. Now, wrapping today, you know, in the spring of 1968, a friend and I, he a sophomore, I was a high school junior, and an already accomplished photographer, not me, he was, we went to a coffee house in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, just west of Philadelphia. It was called the Main Point, and it was an intimate showcase for the best and brightest young folk singers and comedians. At the Main Point, I saw the brilliant Dick Gregory, the a cappella geniuses, the Persuasions, folk singers Gordon Lightfoot, James Taylor, a very young James Taylor. And on one star-striking night, we saw the incomparable, the iconic Joni Mitchell. Now, my friend Joel Bernstein took one look, one listen, and fell hard. Without interrupting Joni's sets, we stayed for both. Joel took dozens of photos that night and in the next months traveled to snap her in concert from New York to Ottawa to L.A. Joel moved to California after high school and his photos illuminate the covers of several of Joni's albums and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's After the Gold Rush. The inside photos of that album are Joel's, and Joel has worked also with Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, Crazy Horse, Rita Coolidge, Jackson Brown, Nicolette Larson, Bruce Springsteen, many others. Why do I raise this? Why do I raise this at all? Last week, we all got news that Joni Mitchell is in hospital, and our friend, Dr. Rodney Rowe of Clayton, Georgia, we've heard him before, he shares this. Joni Mitchell, Morgellons disease, and the twilight of stars, Hegira. Rodney says, when asked if reincarnation is real, what I want to come back as, I've always joked Joni Mitchell. Joni has been one of the stars in my firmament since the days of Big Yellow Taxi and Clouds. As Joni moved from her sort of folk rock beginning, the girl from the Bay of Fundy has moved into ever more musically interesting, if less popular, types of music. Her jazzy treatment of Yeats' poem, The Second Coming, her earthy recollection of The Morning After in Coyote, and a host of other songs have highlighted her musical genius, dynamic voice, and range of musical interests. What has not been apparent is that Joni's earthiness included feet of clay. She was recently admitted for an undisclosed medical condition after collapsing at home and has complained of having Morgellons disease, a medical condition that seems to have no definitely determined validity or basis. Morgellons disease is described as skin ulcerations accompanied by crawling sensations and the emergence of fiber-like filaments from the sores. Attempts to characterize these has not revealed anything. Rather, it has revealed a lot of things like cotton fibers from bandages. It's most commonly seen in middle-aged women, maybe accompanied by drug use, illegal or legal, and seems linked to chronic fatigue syndrome and depression. I first became aware of the condition as a medical student on psychiatric rotation. I was given this really interesting patient in the outpatient clinic to evaluate and treat. The patient was a middle-aged black woman with excoriations all over her arms. She maintained there were bugs crawling under her skin and she wanted something to kill them, but there were no bugs, no parasites. She'd been worked up in the medical clinic and all of that had been excluded. When I explained to her that the crawling sensations were in her head, she told me that I needed to go back and read my doctor book. Next time I saw someone with bugs under his skin was a helicopter crew chief in Vietnam. This was a top-rated crew chief. To understand this person, have to know that the crew chief was at the flight line well before the rest of the crew arrived, responsible for maintenance and pre-flight inspection of the helicopter, manned the 50-cal machine gun on the left side of the helicopter, do several hours of maintenance, post-flight inspection when the unit returned. I sent the crew chief to the 3rd Field Hospital in Saigon for evaluation. The internist had seen all of this before and sent the crew chief to the detox ward, where he was brought off his methamphetamine and readied for an administrative discharge. How did the young soldier get on the amphetamines? He'd started taking them to stay up all those hours of taking care of the helicopters. He had flown over 100 straight days because while the Army kept records of the flight time of pilots and co-pilots, they kept no records of the enlisted crew members. I don't know what drugs Joni may or may not be taking. I don't care that she may be, quote, only, unquote, depressed. I don't care if she has an imaginary condition. I just hope she gets some resolution because she's still my hero. She gave us all a rich tapestry to admire, and if the thread has come loose, if the thread has come loose at the edge, it is, she is, no less beautiful. And I know my high school friend, genius photographer Joel Bernstein, he'd agree. And you know what beauty and justice look like? You do. You know. Follow this show on Twitter at jwolf41387. Keep trying to live as if justice matters, as if what you and your kids do matter. Be creative, courageous. Take your place on that great Mandela, next to Bud Clayman, Voice Today, Mariah Stevenson, and the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance, Padraig Coleman, Carrie Ann Songbird, Amy Abbott, Dr. Rodney Rowe, and yes, right next to me, because this is our brief moment of time, Phil Oakes. And I wish Joel Bernstein, oh, I wish Joel Bernstein had the chance to work with that sad genius, Phil Oakes. Phil Oakes said, I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. He was so very right. You, go repair this crazy place. You can, I promise. When you act on justice's behalf, it pays back. And it will most definitely make you happy. I am gonna see you right here. For our 75th, at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on the Starcom Radio and Satellite Network. And do right now, follow the show on Twitter at jwolf41387, because there and everywhere, it's passionate justice.
We gotta get out of this place. You know it too.